President Trump has finally unveiled his long-awaited yet highly controversial Middle East plan.
This is an unprecedented and highly significant development. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for having the courage to take this bold step forward.
We discussed the plan and how it could actually affect both Israel and Palestine. I'm Arun Vanagopal, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway for January 29th. Also on the show, we dive into the fast-moving sexual assault trial of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein.
What we are seeing from the defense is more questioning the picture that the women are painting, much more than the basis of the facts.
Plus, a look at gender-specific pronouns and the additional challenges they can present for women in politics.
The word she or the word woman does not appear in the Declaration of Independence. What does that subtly send as a message to women in this country?
We start in the Middle East. Let's get going. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump announced his long-awaited plan for the Middle East, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood next to him.
This is an unprecedented and highly significant development. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for having the courage to take this bold step forward.
The plan, which Trump is calling Peace to Prosperity, lays the groundwork for what Trump and Netanyahu say is a two-state solution, but would in fact only give a Palestinian state limited sovereignty. It also gives Israel the green light to maintain control over its settlements in the long-contested West Bank region, and addresses another contested place in all this, Jerusalem.
Under this vision, Jerusalem will remain Israel's undivided, very important, undivided capital.
Trump said the proposed plan is a win-win for both Israel and Palestine, but the actual details strongly favor Israel. Most significantly, Palestinians were not involved in the negotiation of this plan and rejected the proposal before it was even released. The so-called peace plan's unveiling comes at a time when both Trump and Netanyahu are wrapped up in political controversies. Here in the U.S., the impeachment trial is still underway in the Senate, and in Israel, Netanyahu is facing corruption charges while also preparing for yet another election in March. We're joined now by Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, focusing on U.S. foreign policy. He's also a former State Department Middle East negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Shibli Talhami, a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shibli, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Tell us, Aaron, what are the major points that the president outlined in his plan yesterday?
I mean, it's clear that what the administration has done in announcing a long-awaited and I would argue ill-named peace plan has all kinds of objectives, but negotiating Israeli-Palestinian peace is not one of them. On the three core issues that are germane and with which American negotiators, Israelis, Palestinians have struggled for decades, what to do about the territorial component of a two-state solution, how to handle the very volatile and emotional, religiously driven issue of Jerusalem, and the matter of Palestinian refugees. On each of these points, the administration has come down solidly, in my judgment, on the side of Israeli needs and requirements, trivializing and ignoring Palestinian ones. Bottom line here, to me, is that, yes, this is about politics. It's about Netanyahu's domestic situation, Trump's desire to help him, about Trump's own reelection, needs secure evangelical support, conservative Republicans and the like. But above all, what's driving this plan and why it's going to fail is it purports to revise decades of American policy, failed though it may have been, on how to create, in my judgment, the least bad solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is a two-state solution.
Shibli, it is striking, even Orwellian, for the administration to call this a peace plan when one side was entirely absent. And even more striking, I think, is that this term, peace plan, has been adopted by much of the U.S. media, including the New York Times, the AP, MSNBC. What, if anything, does this tell us?
Well, this is really unfortunate. It does tell you that the Trump administration has succeeded in some ways in framing the issue over the many months that it's been talking about it as a peace deal or deal of the century, when in fact it has very little to do with peace, and certainly it's not even a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What it is a plan, an annexation plan. It's really a plan to help the Israeli right implement what it has always wanted, which is legitimize Israeli settlements, annex Jerusalem, annex other parts of the West Bank, and give the Palestinians minimal control in the territories where they live.
Now, according to the plan, Palestinians would be given a path to statehood if they meet a set of tests. What are those tests?
Well, first of all, let's think about what, even if they meet those tests, what we're talking about here. Israel would control the waters. Israel would control the air. Israel would control the borders. Israel would control the security. Even the passive security path or the security for the path linking Palestinian enclaves in Israeli territory and the path linking Jewish enclaves in Palestinian territory. So what we're talking about here is non-contiguous territories. We're talking about very limited control that would sovereign meaning in the way we understand sovereignty. So it's more like autonomy than a state. It's just a name, a label given to it called a state.
The administration has repeatedly singled out Palestinian leadership. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was the driving force behind this peace plan, and he spoke about the leadership in very unflattering terms yesterday on CNN with Christiane Amanpour.
You have 5 million Palestinians who are really trapped because of bad leadership. So what we've done is we've created an opportunity for their leadership to either seize or not. If they screw up this opportunity, which again, they have a perfect track record of missing opportunities. If they screw this up, I think that they will have a very hard time looking the international community in the face, saying they're victims, saying they have rights. This is a great deal for them. If they come to the table and negotiate, I think they can get something excellent.
Aaron, given Kushner's hostile tone, what does that say about how the Trump administration is viewing the leadership in all of this?
Well, from the beginning, I've had a half a dozen meetings with Mr. Kushner, and I have to say that during our first meeting with him, I said to him half jokingly, I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as his father-in-law had in him, because he's given him Mission Impossible. And I made it unmistakably clear to him he couldn't fix this problem. It's up to the Israelis and Palestinians with fair and judicious American mediation to take the kinds of decisions that are required. But from the beginning, he clearly identified for me what he considered to be the major problem. And that was a Palestinian leadership that was dysfunctional. It had failed. Right now, the Palestinian national movement looks like Noah's Ark. There's two of everything. Two statelets, one in Gaza, one in the West Bank, two sets of security services, two separate constitutions, two visions of where Palestine should be and what it should be. So this notion that the Palestinians were the root cause of the problem has informed the Trump administration's approach to this issue from the get-go. And it's reflected. And I have to say, I worked for Republicans and Democrats and voted for them, too. I've never seen an administration in the 25 years I worked on this problem more preternaturally supportive of Israel, applying ample amounts of honey at every opportunity, and literally at political and economic war and confrontation with the Palestinians, applying only vinegar. This has been a central tenet, I think, of the Kushner-Trump-Friedman plan from the beginning. You make the Palestinians dependent on the Arab states, and you make it unmistakably clear to them that they've lost. And Shibley rightly brings up David Friedman as a bankruptcy attorney. The logic for the I think for the Trump administration is the following. It's Friday, you get 50 cents on the dollar. If you don't agree by Sunday, it's 25 cents on the dollar. And if you're still not convinced by Monday or the following week, we'll give you a dime on the dollar. And that's the logic here. And frankly, I don't care where you stand or sit on this conflict. Unless you really try to meet the core needs of both parties and strive for a balance of interests, not much difference than a good marriage, a good business proposition, a good friendship. Each side needs to have their needs and core requirements met with the understanding that they also need a compromise in an effort to reach a workable and equitable solution. That's not the Trump administration's approach.
Shibley, we've been talking about the Palestinian leadership, but how are the Palestinian people responding to this?
Well, of course, they read it as a cruel joke. I mean, to think the Palestinian people think that Jared Kushner has their interests in mind is a joke of the century. This is the administration that not only, quote, took Jerusalem off the table, a very central issue to every Palestinian, but also cut off humanitarian aid to the Palestinians and to the refugee agencies, particularly UNRWA, in a way that has hurt the Palestinians in a real way at a very deep level. So obviously that's a joke. And in fact, when you read the documents say, oh, the Palestinians deserve this and the Palestinians have suffered, I think it does sound to them like a cruel joke. But with regard to the leadership, you know, undoubtedly, you could make criticism of the leadership, and I think it's warranted, and Palestinians themselves make criticism of the leadership. But let me say this. There's no Palestinian leader, right or left, moderate or hardliner, religious or non-religious, who in any shape or form could possibly accept any version of this plan. So this is a joke also to say, to blame it on Palestinian leadership.
Aaron, while Netanyahu was in Washington this week, Israel's attorney general formally indicted him on corruption charges. How does that factor into this rollout?
It's really interesting, and we're really in terra incognita here because there's never been an indictment of a sitting Israeli prime minister charged with bribery, breach of trust, and fraud. He applied for immunity by a date certain, but then he, yesterday, day before, withdrew immunity. So technically, well, he's now formally been indicted by the attorney general as a consequence of withdrawing his request for immunity. And now the issue is when to schedule a trial. And the Supreme Court may actually have to rule on whether or not it is legal, lawful, assuming Mr. Netanyahu fares well enough in the next election to put together a government, whether it is lawful for a indicted prime minister to actually put together a government. I suspect they'll rule in his favor. But just one additional point on this. You know, Ehud Olmert, former prime minister, was indicted, although he had resigned, and formally charged, I believe, in 2009. The indictment was not upheld till 2016, 7 years later, and then he served 8 months in jail. This is not going to end quickly.
What has Netanyahu's political opponent, Benny Gantz, said about this plan?
Gantz is trapped, and I think we have to get over the notion that the fundamental divide in Israeli politics today is between left and right. It's not. The left has been completely decimated. The Labor Party that helped create the state and led it up until 1977 as a dominant party is a shadow of its former self. The debate in Israel is between the right wing, the Netanyahu bloc, including the religious parties and the Zionist nationalists, and the center right, headed by Mr. Gantz, who, frankly, is a representative of the old right, of the old Likud. Gantz is going to have a very hard time challenging Netanyahu on this position because there's great consensus on the Jordan Valley. There may well be a fair amount of consensus on applying Israeli law to the settlement blocks and the settlements. Gantz would probably take a more pragmatic approach if he were running the railroad, but he's not. So here he's going to have to play a kind of second fiddle again until the elections. Should he do well? I think Shibley made the point earlier that he'd be less inclined, you know, to formally annex and or provoke.
Shibley Tilhami, professor of government politics at the University of Maryland. Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. Thank you both.
Arun,
good to be with you.
In a downtown Manhattan courthouse, the trial of Harvey Weinstein has been moving quickly. The Hollywood mogul is accused of raping a woman in 2013 and sexually assaulting another in 2006. He's pleaded not guilty and denied all allegations. The prosecution has already brought several women to testify against the former producer, and they shared graphic details of their assaults. Meanwhile, the defense has worked to undermine their allegations, including by pointing to one victim's continued contact with Weinstein after the alleged assault. For more on how the trial is proceeding, I'm joined by Clémence Michelon. She's a U.S. culture writer for The Independent. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me again.
So tell us, Clémence, what is the atmosphere like inside the courtroom?
So this courtroom is a very tense environment. I was notably there the day of the opening arguments where the prosecution gave
no holds barred, blistering opening statement. As you might expect, it's a very contentious atmosphere, a lot of objections on the defense's part, most of them overruled, some of them were allowed. The assistant district attorney, so speaking on behalf of the prosecution, pointing to Weinstein, calling him a rapist, really trying to engage with the jury.
And are the survivors or the alleged survivors of his assaults present in the courtroom as well?
Some of them have been inside the courtroom as witnesses. And we have heard from one of the two women whose allegations have led to the charges he's facing right now. Her name is Mimi Halle, and she is the woman whose claims have led to the 2006 charge. And we have heard from other women who also say they were attacked by Weinstein. Their stories are too old to lead to new criminal charges because the statute of limitations has run out. But the prosecution is having them on the stand as witnesses to try to build what they say is a picture of recurring predatory behavior from Weinstein.
Last time the Takeaway spoke to you, the trial was just about to begin, and one of the things that stood out was that the jury selection process was going to take 2 weeks. How complicated was that process ultimately?
It did last 2 weeks, so the predictions were correct, which is on the longer side for jury selection. More than 100 potential jurors were dismissed. The whole point was to find jurors who could rule on the criminal charges as neutrally as possible. And we had cases where people who had read Ronan Farrow's book, Catch and Kill, which is about his entire investigation, because he was one of the journalists who broke the Weinstein story in 2017. So the people who had said they'd read this book were dismissed. There were a couple of issues. So the prosecution accused the defense of systematically trying to remove young women from the jury. The defense said, no, that's not what we're doing. What we are doing is trying to get a jury that understands how relationships and conversations between men and women worked in the 90s. But ultimately, they settled on 7 men and 5 women.
You mentioned that we've already heard from one of the women accusing Weinstein. What was her story?
So Mimi Halle alleges that Weinstein forced oral sex on her. And it was a very strong, powerful testimony. She was sobbing at times. And then that testimony was supported the next day by her former roommate, who said Weinstein would allegedly show up to their apartment unannounced, and that Halle recounted the alleged assault to her, and the roommate said that she thought it sounded like rape and said, do you want to go to a lawyer? And she says Halle didn't feel that she could or wanted to pursue this for a variety of reasons.
I want to turn now to the defense's strategy in these trials. Could you break down for us what their argument has been?
So far, what we are seeing from the defense isn't so much a debate on the facts as they are presented by the alleged victims, but more their characterization. You know, why did you keep texting him afterwards? Why did you keep seeing him? Were you really scared of him, et cetera? It's more questioning the picture that the women are painting, much more than the basis of the facts.
Why is the defense so focused on this particular idea?
A lot of people have these conceptions, right? That people still think that rape and assault is still a matter of strangers in dark alleys. And the defense is going after the credibility of the women. If they're using this argument, it's because they think it's going to resonate with the jury. It's because they think it's their best shot at getting an acquittal. And because these are very strong, powerful ideas that have been in our society for a while. Now, the prosecution is trying to counterbalance that by, first of all, having a number of women take the stand. And they also questioned a forensic psychiatrist who also testified in the Cosby trial. And she was trying to dispel myths about sexual assault and rape and the people who are victims, for example, explaining that most survivors keep in touch with their attacker.
So in that sense, it's been about 3 years or so since Harvey Weinstein was accused, and it fundamentally changed our culture, at least in the public discourse. Is there any way to know if the changes we're seeing outside of the courtroom are impacting what's happening inside the courtroom?
That was the whole issue, right, during jury selection, which we were just talking about. It's strange in a way because this is a trial that is very much of its time. you know, it's the second high-profile trial of the Me Too movement after Bill Cosby. But the entire challenge for both sides was also to find jurors who could presumably set that aside and rule solely on the criminal charges. And that might seem a little weird or a little counterintuitive, but that is how it works inside the courtroom.
Hmm. I've been really interested in hearing your accounts of covering this trial, and I'd like to read an excerpt from a recent piece you wrote in The Independent. You say, "It's interesting to note that journalists are not explicitly expected to doubt people who say they've been victims of other types of crimes. The word accuser symbolizes how fraught the situation is. It's almost exclusively used in the context of sexual misconduct allegations. Someone says they've been robbed. The default mode is to believe them unless specific elements suggest they might be lying. They're not an accuser. They're the alleged victim of a crime. What's the point you were trying to make?"
The point I was trying to make, which I feel strongly about, is that believing people isn't bias. Believing people who say they were abused, it's not optional. When you're covering those things, of course there's always a level of fact-checking. Of course you're going to cross-reference things. And in terms of ruling on the facts and on whether there should be a conviction, that's the role of the jury and the court, and that's still happening more than 2 years after the allegations first came out. And I think if someone is going to go inside the courtroom and cover what's going on inside, it is their duty to also have a working understanding of the justice system and how it often fails survivors of sexual assault for many reasons. But we know a lot of those allegations never lead to conviction. And I think empathy is a very key value in what we do.
In terms of the trial, what next?
So things are moving faster than expected. The trial was originally expected to last for 4 weeks, which would have taken us into February. Now it looks like the prosecution is almost done calling all the witnesses that they have said they would. I believe early next week they should be done with that. That's just according to what we know. Of course, there's always the possibility that they have something else up their sleeve that we don't know about. So we're expecting more testimony from more women who either say they were attacked by Weinstein or are friends or relatives or know in some capacity women who have come forward against him and who are trying to support their testimony.
Updates from the Harvey Weinstein trial. We appreciate the help, Clémence. Clémence Michelon is the U.S. culture writer for The Independent.
Thanks so much for having me.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I will do what a president can do all by herself on the very first day.
If you want to do something about racial justice and immigration reform and climate change and gun safety, we need a candidate who is actually going to bring people with her.
With her, by herself. Both Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren referred to the presidency with female pronouns during the most recent presidential debate. That caught the ear of the New York Times' Jessica Bennett.
I've always been really fascinated by the way that small linguistic turns of phrase can actually reflect culture, but sometimes even impact it. And I was surprised to find that something as simple as a pronoun, she or her, could actually potentially influence the way we think about candidates.
Bennett's a writer and editor at the New York Times focused on gender and culture, and is the author of the book Feminist Fight Club. And she told me there's new research out of MIT on Americans' use of the she pronoun when talking about presidential candidates.
Researchers found that people sort of hesitate to use she or her when talking about a hypothetical president. And then they found that in a reading setting, the word actually causes people to cognitively stumble. They lose a third of a second in reading time, which is significant when you think about reading time. And the way that they measured this was they observed people clicking through a touch screen where they were reading sentences. And every time they were moving to a new word, they had to touch the screen. And as soon as the word she or her popped up, they sort of stumbled.
So it's basically like some sort of a like a speed bump during the sentence that they just like, wait, this doesn't make sense.
That's exactly how it is. And I think that people aren't necessarily conscious of this, but it's causing them to cognitively sort of do a double take.
So is this both in terms of how people read as well as how they speak?
Yeah, what the researchers found was that in speaking categories, they were less likely or more reluctant to use that word. They were looking at primarily voters in the lead up to the 2016 election. They were thinking, of course, language influences the way people think, and also world events influence language. So this was a time when many people believed Hillary Clinton may in fact be president. So could that actually have an impact on the way that people spoke? And what they found, which they were somewhat surprised by, was that no, it turns out it didn't seem to influence language.
So is there evidence that our reluctance to use the she pronoun could actually affect our willingness to vote for a woman?
So that's sort of the million-dollar question. Can you connect linguistic biases to actual biases? There's not concrete evidence to support that, but the theory is that all of this plays a role in how we think about power. And oftentimes lurking behind our language are actually sort of unconscious or subconscious beliefs about who can be in positions of power. And so the researchers posit that, yeah, you know, it is possible that this can actually influence who we are voting for, because there's this whole idea of needing to normalize the idea that a woman can be president. And if we're so tripped up by a mere pronoun, does that mean we're tripped up by the concept at large?
When I think of all the countries that have had women prime ministers or presidents, Sri Lanka, India, Israel, so many really, it really does make me wonder about this country and its own hangups. Is this an especially American phenomenon?
So what was really interesting was that they replicated the study a year later in the UK. What they found there was that people were actually less reluctant to use the pronoun. And of course, the UK had Theresa May at the time and has had Thatcher. And so there's this evidence, I guess, to show that having women in power, having women in the highest office, can in fact have an impact. I mean, it's sort of this catch-22 in a lot of ways, because it's like, to normalize the language and the feeling, you have to have the person, but to get the person, you kind of need to normalize the language and the feeling. So there is research that shows even that the fact that we are talking about this and that we continue to talk about these questions of, can a woman be president or is she electable, actually goes toward proving that it's a valid question in the first place. And so research has found that in some cases, even talking about a potential bias can actually increase the bias.
So this is what we're actually doing right now, is potentially increasing the bias, the gender bias.
I definitely had that thought when I was writing the piece. And I think the researchers had that thought when they were conducting the study. But, you know, these are critical things that we're talking about here.
Is it clear whether someone who takes more time to use the word she in relation to, say, a president or a presidential candidate is more likely to harbor doubts than someone who takes less time?
I don't think necessarily. I think that we would find that even people like you and I might stumble subconsciously or unconsciously over that word. And it was interesting. I was speaking with the linguist Deborah Tannen, who has done a lot of work on this topic. And she was telling me a story about how even she has found herself getting tripped up by these types of things. Mm. So she recently met with a group of female judges. And the judges were describing how they were often, when they were presiding over the court, referred to as sir. And their theory was that, you know, people are nervous, they're trying to show respect, and they are calling these women sir. And Deborah Tannen was saying, who is Dr. Tannen, she has a PhD, that she has made that same slip up when it comes to the word doctor, assuming that a doctor was a man, not a woman. And she, of course, is doctor and goes by doctor. So even she, the linguist who studies gender and language, does it.
You also spoke to a famed linguist, Robin Lakoff, about this. What does she have to say about what's in play here?
She was one of the first linguists to really study this idea that the way we speak not only reflects the culture and the moment in time, but it can actually have subtle, small influences on the way we see things. And so to her, this was really reflective of the way that maybe we are not quite ready to see a woman in power, which she sees as evidenced by 2016. But again, to what we were talking about previously, the more we keep talking about this, to what extent does that actually make it a valid question to be asking?
Have candidates themselves taken any of this into account in their campaigns that we can see?
Yeah. So in the last Democratic debate, there were a couple of moments where Elizabeth Warren and then Amy Klobuchar both used she and her to refer to not just themselves, but a future president. So Warren said, if I am elected on my first day in office, I will do anything that's possible for a president to do all by herself. So whether that was conscious or not, she is using the pronoun. She's not using they. She's not using he or she. And we've seen Kamala Harris, when she was still on the debate stage, doing this very frequently and, in fact, has spoken about how she really thinks about language and the importance of language. And when she took office in California, in fact, went back through the laws and removed all of the male pronouns from a lot of the statutes. And that's actually what we've seen a number of states do in recent years. Washington State, where I'm from originally, is one of them, where they've gone back through and taken words like ombudsman that were in the law and changed them to be gender neutral, ombuds.
So we know that this bias exists. Sexism is real. What can we do about it?
I think what we can do about it is try to remember that a lot of the subtleties, a lot of these subtly sexist things make their way into our everyday language. And it's not necessarily our fault. But, you know, we have all of these words that are inherently male. The word she or the word woman does not appear in the Declaration of Independence. What does that subtly send as a message to women in this country? And it's been actually funny to see, as we have this historic number of women who won in the 2018 midterm elections, to keep seeing the word written and spoken, freshman congresswoman, over and over again. And it's such a tiny thing, but why are they freshmen? Why is male the default in so much of our language? And the question, of course, is does that have an impact?
Jessica Bennett is a writer and editor at the New York Times focused on gender and culture. Jessica, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you. Have any of the female candidates' pronoun use stood out to you? How might these issues play out with a future candidate who uses a pronoun like they? And how do we get better at talking about our biases? We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and that's it for us today. Thanks for being with us. Till tomorrow, I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.